Hey everybody, welcome to episode 115 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back, welcome aboard. Today I am coming to you from a motel room in Bend, Oregon. I'm currently traveling across the western U.S. interviewing a variety of people to appear on this very podcast later this season. But on today's show, we have a special treat for you. We are speaking with Liz Del Sol. We cover a range of topics from skydiving to scuba diving and shark diving in particular. We hit up cycling, cycle touring, acting, performing, and the part I am most excited to share with all of you is something we have never talked about, which is magic and performing as a magician. So let's head over to Los Feliz in Los Angeles, California, and talk to Liz Del Sol.
I'm Liz Del Sol. I was born in Monterrey, Mexico. I grew up in South Texas, but since I was 7 years old, I wanted to live in Hollywood. And here we are, many, many years later, sitting in Hollywood, having this conversation.
That's right. We were sitting in Hollywood because they would not allow us to sit in Griffith Park.
That is correct. That's my playground, Griffith Park. I love that place. But here we are in my backyard.
That's right. We got kicked out because we tried to be there precisely at sunset, which apparently makes the city of Los Angeles very unhappy for two people to be in the park at sunset. So you get your picture of the sun going down and then get the hell out. That's what city of LA says.
Yep.
So you grew up in Mexico. When did you move to the U.S.?
I was 3 years old when my family migrated us. My dad got a job with Levi Strauss.
So you did not grow up in Mexico. You were just born in Mexico.
But until 3 years old. That's it. Yes.
Not a lot of life experience at that point.
No, but we visited all the time. We were only 3 hours away from where I was born, so we'd go once a month as I was growing up. Felt like an eternity, 3 hours, but of course now, you know, as an adult, 3 hours is nothing.
And you said you grew up in Texas then?
South Texas, right on the border, which felt like Mexico because it was all Hispanics.
So which city would that be?
Brownsville, right by South Padre Island, right by Matamoros. Completely different place these days.
What was life like in South Texas when you were older than 3 years old?
Well, I've always, you know, seeked adventure. So I did a lot of sneaking out of my window and going to Matamoros where, you know, as long as you could look over the counter, you could order anything you wanted and you can get into the nightclubs with a fake high school ID. So I was always, you know, getting myself into trouble.
And this was from the age of 4 years old and up?
At about the age of 12 is when, you know,
right, is when you decided.
Started pushing the limits. At 15, I was pretty wild. Yeah, I just wanted to grow up and get out of Texas, though.
Yeah, I can understand that. Not to bash on Texas, but it's not my favorite state. There are definitely nice parts of Texas, but there's a lot of Texas that I'm just happy not to spend time in. So hopefully I'm not sending away listeners or potential listeners. But having grown up in Louisiana, which was also a great place to grow up, I know that exact feeling of I need to attain a certain age and get out of here.
Spread my wings is all I wanted to do.
Right. And so when was it that you got out of Texas?
Well, my parents wouldn't let me study out of state. I wanted to come to California or go to New York, and I got a scholarship to Texas A&M, and it's a pretty darn good school. So I went there, got my bachelor's, got my master's, threw it in my mom's face, said, here's your darn degree. I'm off to Hollywood now.
And what were those degrees in?
I have a bachelor's in environmental design and a master of science in visualization sciences. Basically, that was my ticket to Hollywood because I interned at Pixar Animation Studios and worked on Monsters, Inc., but I knew that I didn't want to spend my life in front of a computer. It was just a reason to move, basically, because all the jobs are in California or New York, even though I never got a job doing that after working at Pixar. I led a completely different life.
So when you were on Monsters, Inc., what specifically were you doing on that job?
At Pixar, I was a technical director. I went through Pixar University. Mm-hmm. On Monsters, Inc., they asked me to do them a favor and be a production assistant because they didn't want to hire anybody from the outside. And so even though I went to work as a technical director, they said, could you please, you'll get a film credit. And I said, okay. So credited in the movie as a production assistant in the lighting department.
So I don't want to make anyone listening to this hate you, because right now there's somebody listening saying, oh, all I want in life is to work for Pixar. and you had the opportunity to do it and you didn't want it and you left. So just know that not all people have the same goals in life.
Yeah.
So what were you ultimately drawn to Los Angeles for? Why did you want to come to Hollywood? Because clearly it wasn't to work for Pixar, because that would be a pretty good place for a lot of people to work.
No, I wanted to pursue the acting career. That's all I ever wanted to do, perform. And I love theater. And I got into film and television and realized my passion is in live theater. And when the acting career didn't roll as quickly as I wanted, that's when I decided, well, these acting classes aren't really serving me. They're not leading to more work. I'm going to take classes for fun. And I landed in classes at the Magic Castle. And one class led to another. And I was like, OMG. All my life, I thought I was an actor. But in my heart, I'm a magician. You don't grow up thinking women magicians, but it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And now it's over a decade that I've just been completely consumed in magic, loving every single aspect of it, from close-up to parlor to stage. I want to know it all.
And I know we're running through years really quickly here, but this is a very interesting, and I don't even think ironic's the right word, but in some ways, ironic progression. Your initial goal was to become an actor, which is one of the most difficult things
indeed
you can do. You went to Los Angeles and you landed a job working for Pixar, which is a very difficult thing to do. And you left that to pursue becoming an actor, but found magic, which is probably even a smaller subset of performers. No, guaranteed smaller subset of performers than acting is.
Yep.
So that is amazing to me.
Pixar was part of my graduate program, but some of the students that got the opportunity I did, which was just a handful, actually stayed at Pixar and never went back and finished their degree.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't one of those. I went and I had my 9 months at Pixar, went back, finished my degree, then threw in my mom's face and I said, I'm off to Hollywood to pursue the acting.
And were you a performer in school when you were living in Texas?
Oh my gosh. I've been trying to be in any production I could get my hands on since before I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
In third grade, I came home and apparently this is a story to me because
oh,
I was
so
young.
Were you Cactus number two?
A what?
I just know in children's theater, it's always like, this person's
cactus.
The sun, this person's a cactus. And then this person's Annie.
Oh, I got a bunch of those stories. But I came home and I told my mom, will you make me a costume? Because I want to be Frosty and Frosty the Snowman. I don't remember this, but there are photos of me dressed as Frosty.
All right, sweet. So that was how you got your big break, was as Frosty the Snowman.
Yeah, well, that was my first leading role.
That's right. You're damn right it was. Was it a musical version of Frosty? I know you don't recall it, but maybe you've been informed.
Yes, actually. I do remember there was music involved and there was singing involved, sure.
And did you have a Frosty song? Was it the Frosty song?
That I don't remember. But all as I was growing up, any opportunity to perform beyond stage, I did it. In high school, I competed actually in one-act plays where I won all-star cast. And I'm like, that's it. I know it. I'm going to be the greatest actor. I just need to move to Hollywood. Then they changed the theater teacher at the high school I was at. And she did not cast me in the school play because
she casted somebody else's Frosty.
I was in the play in my freshman year and I won all-star cast. I was in it in my sophomore year again, won all-star cast. And then they changed theater teachers and she did not cast me because she cast an all-white cast, even though I was in a school that was 95% Hispanics.
Yeah, and it seems like that would be difficult to do.
Yeah, and she was told to cast me because I'm good. And that's when I started experiencing the reality that I thought Hollywood would be different, you know? That
boy, were you wrong.
Yeah. The first thing that I got cast at as when I moved to Hollywood, they made me into a chola.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and they put me in a hoopty car bouncing up and down. I was fresh out of my master's degree, and I'm like, wow, all that education, and they're having me play a gangbanger.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Yeah, so congratulations. You went from Pixar to Chola number 12.
Exactly.
Did they even have you draw on your eyebrows?
Yes,
say, oh,
with the big hoop earrings, with the bandana. Absolutely.
So you're a performer growing up. You know you eventually want to go to Hollywood, and you end up on this really interesting path that eventually brings you to magic. And along that way, I know that because it's people listening, they know this is an outdoor podcast, and they're like, why are they talking
talking about acting so much. I know that a part of your life is largely outdoors and running and a variety of other things. And the way you and I initially met was years ago in Carl's Extreme Things Club.
Yes.
Which people have heard me talk about on this show, which is what led to me getting into everything. So how did that work for you? Were you an outdoors kid in Texas, or did this come later?
This definitely came later, but it's interesting because for several years I was working as head of development at Bilingual Foundation of the Arts, as I was every single production of theirs. So I was in seven productions back to back. And that whole stint that I was doing all this theater, I kept going to Extreme Things website and just dreaming of the day that I could participate in all those events. So I could only squeeze in one here and there because I was doing this theater. And I thought, well, but this theater is going to lead to greater things. But the whole time I was dreaming of going on these extreme adventures.
And a really quick thing for listeners, the Extreme Things Club, old friend of ours, Carl, had created. And this is pre-meetup. It's pre-Groupon. It's kind of before a lot of those things. We're talking early to mid-2000s. And so I know when I stumbled upon it, it was the only thing like that that I had found. How did you come across it? I was looking for climbing lessons when I found it. How did you stumble upon his website?
I've always been into adrenaline and extreme things. And so when I was working on my master's, there was a skydiving club at Texas A&M. And I really wanted to go skydiving. And my mom was, no, you're not going to go kill yourself. Absolutely not. I'm not going to pay for that. So when I finally had a little bit of money, because I was taking odd jobs here and there, I decided I'm going skydiving because Bush Senior had gone skydiving at Texas A&M for his like 82nd birthday or something crazy.
And I'm like, Mom, if he can do it, exactly.
So then I signed up and went skydiving on a Sunday, fell in love with it, and I knew this is it. I want to go skydiving. I'm going to be part of the club. I'm going to get certified. This is my calling. I love it. And the following weekend, it happened to be a holiday. My mom said, everyone's coming home. You're the only one that's not coming. And she gave me the guilt trip. She's like, come home. You can start your skydiving lessons the following weekend. I'm like, okay. And spend time with family. I'm driving back to university. And my friend calls me. She's like, where are you? I'm like, I'm driving back to school. She goes, the plane fell. I'm like, what? Yeah. So the plane's name was Ducky because it was being held together by duct tape. Mm-hmm. Everyone inside the plane, the jump master, who I had conversed with him quite a bit, he had 1,500 jumps under his belt. He had a baby a few months old. The pilot, the videographer, I mean, his entire crew of five. And instead of me, it was an 18-year-old girl celebrating her birthday. And the plane failed at 3,000 feet, took a nosedive. And so the skydiving program was frozen, and I never got to skydive again.
What happened to everyone on the plane?
Well, they all died. They all perished.
Did they all die?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I did not pursue skydiving, but I always had that interest of doing things that cause that adrenaline to pump, because it is really good for you. You know, calculated risk and adrenaline and, you know, a level of fear is actually very good for the body. Then I was just seeking something that would give me that sort of adrenaline here in L.A., that was different from that. And that's when I found Extreme Things. I'm like, oh, that sounds amazing. And what? It's only $50 a year to be a part of this? You can go on adventures for free? Yes.
Yeah, I know. That was the thing. I remember some people would hear that it costs money. And it's like, you guys don't understand. It doesn't cost very much.
No.
And he vets everything that we do. Since then, I've joined meetups and other things. And sometimes you show up and it can be a mess. It's like, well, we're going to do this thing. No one in this group has done it. We're not sure how it's going to work out. And sometimes it goes great. Sometimes it falls apart. Or I've heard horror stories. People show up and go follow someone to do something they're completely ill-prepared for. With Extreme Things, Carl would go out, do every activity ahead of time, make sure he knew what was happening, make sure he had the skills and everything to keep everybody safe. And there were very rarely any sort of mishaps or any sort of mishaps that he couldn't handle. I don't think there was ever a mishap that he couldn't handle.
Nope.
And so for $50 or whatever it was a year, it was a super good deal.
Absolutely. And then we would share all the expenses. So the first time I climbed Half Dome was with you.
I've since gone back to do it again.
And then we went rappelling through the slot canyons.
That was another incredible thing
that we got to do. And I could trust that he could take us on some wild hikes and I wouldn't have to worry about getting lost.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's the one who taught me about having the proper gear and doing tick checks, and just learned so much from him. It was amazing.
Do you remember what the first activity you did with the group was?
It was a hike but I don't recall which hike it was, because we'd go to Los Angeles National Forest. There was a bunch of hikes that we did there.
Yeah, there was always like a variety of hikes and then kind of the big trips. And like you just named a few of them. Like we went to Zion and the Slot Canyons you're talking about specifically, because some people listening will know, there's the baby possum in your yard. the Slot Canyons specifically you're talking about are Pine Creek and Keyhole, which we did back to back. Yeah, like you mentioned, Half Dome, and then a variety of other activities. So that was kind of what got you into everything, was joining that club, like knowing you wanted to do those things and then finding that club and then having like that group who could get those activities together for you.
Yeah.
How long had you been in LA at that time? Do you remember when you joined the
group? Well, if I was working at Bilingual Foundation of the Arts, it must have been at least 7 or 8 years.
Okay. So yeah, several years, which was kind of what happened with me too. Moved to LA, lived here for a few years. Takes a long time sometimes to establish yourself in any sort of functioning way.
Oh yeah.
In Los Angeles. And then you can finally decide, hey, let me look around me and see what there is to do. Because, yeah, that was very much what happened with me, too, is I was here for years. And then finally, I was like, hey, I found this club. Let me go do things other than struggle to survive and try to build a career.
Indeed. It is competition for any kind of work here, even to wait tables. So to get your feet on the ground in L.A. is quite challenging. I spent a lot of time looking for work. Fortunately, now the work comes to me. But it took a long time to get to this point.
Yeah, yeah. You initially wanted to go skydiving. Your mom told you that you were crazy, and then in some ridiculous stroke of fate, she's correct, because the plane would have killed you, which is ridiculous that that would have even been the case. Since then, have you leapt out of an airplane?
Absolutely.
So when did you finally get around to it?
It took 10 years to finally do it again, and I went out to Paris to the skydiving school there. I did accelerated free fall. And then when I was in Fiji, because I went there to scuba dive with shark, because it's one of the top places for shark diving, I went skydiving over Fiji. And then I thought, my ultimate skydiving goal is to skydive over the Swiss Alps. So about 7 years ago, I went out to Interlaken, jumped out of a helicopter, and Matterhorn was right there. It was amazing. And now, you know, if proper training comes, I want to climb Matterhorn. Like it's
no, I do too. Yeah,
yeah,
we
you
were,
too.
We were just there last summer, looking at it from what do they call it, the Glacier Palace or whatever they call it up there, and it's just right across. And yeah,
I would
have loved to have made my way over to it. It's a mountain that looks like what a kid thinks a mountain looks like.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a triangle. And it's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
When you decided to get into skydiving, did you start with a tandem jump or did you just go straight in and say, no, train me to jump alone?
No, I've done, of the four jumps, three have been tandem and one was accelerated free fall. Because with skydiving, you actually have to keep up your certification. Mm-hmm. So that's when I decided to go the scuba dive route. So I'm certified as a scuba diver. I have advanced certification plus a bunch of other certifications. And now I've got almost 100 dives with shark under my belt. And that's kind of, to me, a little bit more accessible, like, to do. And I don't need to keep up a certification with that. So I'll skydive again. But I think that was, to me, the ultimate was to skydive over the Swiss Alps.
So, yeah, you jumped at Lake Elsinore, which is where I did my first jump also, which is kind of east of L.A. over this big lake. In this region that's a little more, I guess, suburban than most of Los Angeles. Where was it before Switzerland? Where else did you go before Switzerland?
Fiji.
Mm-hmm. And you also went diving there.
Yeah, I specifically went for scuba diving with shark. Yeah, because you dive with bull shark.
So let's jump to that for a little bit. So let's talk about that.
I got certified and then I did my first shark dive in the Bahamas, but it was coral reef shark. And I thought it was fascinating. The guys were just wearing chainmail. But something was calling me to go to, I want to go to the best of the best. Every single time I get into an activity, I want to experience the best place in the world. And my research led me to Fiji because they have a shark reserve. And it totally blew my mind. It changed my life. There were more shark handlers than there were passengers on this trip. And so they made you feel really safe. So they have you behind a bunker and there's guys behind you protecting you. And then in front of you are the feeders. And watching these guys dangle the piece of tuna with their hand, they're dangling it. Here comes the shark. They let it go. The shark chomps on it. And then they're petting the shark as they're coming by. They're handling these animals like they're puppies underwater. Mm-hmm. It blew my mind. And that's what led me to research more. And I found shark school. So I spent an entire week in Playa del Carmen scuba diving with bull shark. And the first time we went down, half of the people had already done other shark schools. But those of us that hadn't, you know, we were terrified. We were holding arm to arm next to each other. And our first dive, we go down, there's seven bull shark swimming around us in rotation. And
right. And to verify, this is not cage diving.
No, never. I don't do free, any cage
diving. This is free, open scuba diving, swimming with the sharks, not throwing a bunch of chum in the water and dropping you down in a cage so that you watch a frenzy around you. There's not that, correct?
No, no. And actually, I prefer when they don't chum. Right. But there's certain places like Jupiter, Florida, where the ocean is so vast that you're not going to see them unless they do feed them. And my last dive I did, I had a female shark feeder, and she's been doing it for so long that she's built a relationship with these animals. And they would swim under and then come up vertically up against her body. She'd catch them by the nose and give them nose rubs. And it was obvious these shark were enjoying it. Yeah. And so it was multiple dives that we did on this trip. And the last time I jumped into the water, as soon as I jumped in, there's this lemon shark coming at me with a big grin on its face. You can see all of its teeth. Because of all my experience, I knew exactly what to do. I, you know, grabbed them by the nose and I gently just guided them to the side. Afterwards, I came up out of the water and I'm tripping and I'm telling the woman, "Oh my God, did you see that?" She goes, "Oh yeah, that's Snooty. He's really friendly." And now if you go on Instagram and look up Snooty the lemon shark, there are photos and videos of this shark all over the place because he's like the friendly shark with a big grin on its face. It's incredible.
So after you had gotten your initial certification, how many dives had you done by the time you went diving with a shark?
Two or three.
Okay. So
right
not,
off the bat.
So not enough to be super comfortable and super confident underwater.
Well, the thing is that when the shark are around me, nothing else exists but
that.
Of course. Right. So it actually would calm me. Mm-hmm. And I felt more calm diving with shark because I'm no longer afraid of my gear failing.
Right.
I'm just like laser focused on that.
Like clearing the mask, who cares?
Yeah. So now it's my favorite thing to do.
Let's talk about that very first dive with the shark.
It was the one in the Bahamas, but that was with coral reef. My first time with bull shark was in Fiji.
Okay, so the ones at the coral reef, how large are these sharks?
5 foot.
So like smaller?
Yeah, smaller,
they don't fight
definitely.
You.
No.
Right.
No.
So when was the first time you go in with a shark and it's of a size where if it wants to eat you, it has that option and you have to confront that?
Well, that was
when
in
was
Fiji,
that?
But those, there were so many handlers that they made you feel really safe. Mm-hmm. They had sticks, so they made sure they wouldn't come near you. So I was never afraid.
So yeah, tell us about that experience. What was it like to go down there? Because I'm sure you went in with a preconceived notion, right? Of like, I'm going to go under the water and this is what's going to happen and this is what it's going to feel like. And you were probably wrong.
Well, I didn't have a preconceived notion. And there's plenty of training before you actually go underwater. They explain to you mm-hmm. where you're going to position yourself so you're not in their way. And they explain that they're going to be around you and your behavior just to always be calm, to keep your hands underneath your armpits, never reach out and touch them. You just have to know how to behave around them. And they're really graceful and calm animals. Like everyone says, oh my God, bull shark. They have the most testosterone. They're so aggressive. They're not. They're actually really shy. When I did shark school, they wouldn't come. I mean, they were maybe 3 feet away from you and then they just turn right around and leave because they're shy. You think of them that they're going to come at you and they're curious animals and they're not.
You said you kind of fell in love with this.
Yeah.
With specifically shark diving. So
yeah.
What do you think it was? Is it kind of that concept of here is a predator at the top of its food chain and I get to watch it live its life? And it's very different than what Shark Week and TV has been showing
so
me my
different.
Whole life. Is that the draw or was it something else?
Yes, is that it is not what you see on television. It is not what you've been told. And then when you watch these professionals interact with them, you realize how friendly and calm and just magical they are.
I mean, it's funny because if you really think about it, like we think of animals, like predatory animals, as like monsters in some ways, but they're exactly the same as us. We were the upper part of a food chain that just evolved an intelligence different than the animals around us and then created this society. So in a lot of ways, we're not that different from sharks. We also are predatory animals that devour the things around us. And we are more than that. And maybe I'm not explaining this very well, but there's more to humanity than that we devour other creatures. And so it's a given that it would be the same with predatory animals, that there's more to sharks than just mindless eating machines.
Absolutely. And they are actually so necessary to the entire planet because they're the ones that clean up the ocean. Mm-hmm. They eat the carcasses of the whales that are scattered. Like, they are the garbage picker uppers. They keep our oceans healthy and clean. And so it really bothers me that there's all this shark finning, like just killing of sharks and shark fin soup that really is not good for you, even though some cultures believe that it is. I hope to be able to have the power to continue to educate people so they're aware that there's no reason to be afraid. As long as you do the things, number one, you don't wear yellow underwater or any neon colors. Wear all black.
Is that because it makes you reflective like a fish or something? It gives you, like, the bright maybe makes them think of fish scales or something?
What's the reasoning? It spikes their curiosity. Since they don't have hands to, you know, figure out what you mm-hmm. are, the only thing they have is their mouth. So right. they're going to come take a nibble and see what is this bright colored thing? Mm-hmm. So my friend asked the instructors, because they're great whites in the Pacific right here in right, Los Angeles, yeah. a lot of them. Mm-hmm. In fact, they come have their pups here. And so my friend sees them all the time while she's surfing. She's like, when I see them, what do I do? And this instructor said, you get in the water and face them so they can see that you're not food. So they can see you're a human and then they won't bother you. So you do. It's the opposite of what most people would think. They get on the board and they start paddling away, trying to get away. No. You get in and face them. And they'll know you're not food.
It's going to take a lot of courage for the average person to drop into the water that a great white is in and say, no, I'm not food, see? So when was it that you did this Fiji trip?
It's been years now.
We're talking a decade? We're talking...
A little less than a decade. Yeah.
Is this something you continue to do? Because you said you really kind of fell in love with this shark diving.
Oh, yeah. I try and go at least once a year. Lately, I've just been going to Florida. But I've also dove in Costa Rica. In fact, I want to do Cocos Island. I want to go to the Sea of Cortez. Like, there's a whole bunch of places that I want to explore to dive with shark. But I know that diving is something I can do well into my later years in mm-hmm. life.
Right.
And a lot of these liveaboards, you know, it's a hefty price point to go have these experiences. So right now I'm doing things that are easier on the pocketbook.
Have you ever done the manta ray dive in Kona in Hawaii?
I have not. I have dove in Hawaii, but I have not seen the mantas. Definitely want to do that. But I saw the big giant turtles in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
That water is cold.
The Hawaiian water?
In Hawaii is so cold.
I don't know. We're in Los Angeles where the water
well,
would be like
yeah.
40 degrees. No, the reason I asked, so I've never, I don't have nearly as many dives as you. I have maybe like a dozen or
cool.
15 dives maybe. And the closest thing, I've never dive with sharks, but the closest experience would have been the manta ray night dive
at
in
night
Kona. Yeah,
sweet.
And what makes it particularly so interesting, right, is they bring you down to the bottom. You don't wear a snorkel because the manta rays are going to be literally sliding across your face
cool.
and your forehead. They have you just sit there on your knees around the big light source, and then you have smaller lights in your hand. The idea being, when you hold that up, it attracts plankton, which attracts the manta rays. And then if you're lucky, which apparently we were, right around the time they expect people to be there, the manta rays start swimming in, and they're as wide as 14 feet or so, some of them with that big wingspan, and they look like alien creatures. And if you hold your light up, they will inevitably swim right towards you, and right before they get to their face, they'll just turn 90 degrees and rub across your forehead and swim past you. It is definitely a worthwhile experience.
Amazing.
Because you come so close in contact with it, and you're just watching something that's so different than life on the surface right there in front of you.
Cool.
And there's no danger that they're going to eat you either.
You know, I continue to research places to go diving with shark, and now there are actually places in Hawaii because I don't want to do cage dives. Like,
right,
it's not
right,
necessary.
Right.
And they're starting to because people are learning about the shark's behavior and how they are not dangerous. More and more, you're seeing these outfitters take people out on cageless shark dives, and now there are a couple of places in Hawaii where you can dive with the great shark, the great whites, with no cage. Where that didn't exist 10 years ago when I first started researching,
mm-hmm.
but it's starting to pop up more and more. So I definitely, on my bucket list, is diving with great whites face-to-face, no cage.
Have you had the experience of being able to dive with whale sharks?
Scuba dive, no, but swim with them, absolutely,
oh,
in
nice.
Holbox. And yeah, and I got really lucky because the season that I went, they said it was one of the best seasons ever. There were hundreds of them where there was never a moment where you didn't see one. And mind you, the water's not very clear, so they have to be really close to you for you to see them. And there were times where there were two rubbing up against me that you couldn't avoid them. You're not supposed to touch them. You know, you're supposed to just let them do their thing. But there were so many that they were literally rubbing up against you constantly all the time. So it was pretty incredible.
And they're enormous. Right?
Yeah, enormous.
A friend of mine has swam with them before, and he was saying how swimming alongside of it, looking it in the eye, was this very surreal experience because you feel like you see intelligence, but this creature is enormous,
yep.
But also gentle in a certain way.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're just incredible, and they are just gentle giants. And I recently learned that hammerheads are also gentle giants. You know, never had any fear with them. I was, again, another experience that I, on my bucket list, is the Sea of Cortez, to have 200 of them just flying over your head. But from the first time I saw them, I'm like, these guys are harmless, even though everyone tried to tell me different. Well, now the research is out. And yes, they are also gentle giants, these hammerheads.
So you have been diving many times with sharks, and mm-hmm. at this point you've been diving many times. Has there been any sort of experience where things went awry, something unexpected happened, or an animal reacted a way you didn't anticipate?
Fortunately, no. No, and I hope to not. But when I went diving in Belize, I went specifically to dive the Blue Hole, mm-hmm. and they're nurse sharks. And they'll have these containers where they're feeding them. And so there's like dozens and dozens of nurse shark. So it was pretty incredible to literally get up on them and literally cuddle with them, like literally hug them and cuddle with them. And they're just laying there letting you cuddle with them. Seriously, I was like, this is incredible. They're so chill. Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
So what do you have in the future then for diving plans? It sounds like you have a number of things you would like to do.
Many. When it comes to diving, I feel like I'm still pretty green, even though I have about 100 dives under my belt. But when I go diving, I'm always talking to everybody because I guess I'm a little bit gregarious. And everyone around me's got 1,500 dives, 5,000 dives, right. And all these incredible experiences. I'm like, oh my gosh, I've done nothing when it comes to diving. I'm just getting started. I've had enough people tell me that the Great Barrier Reef is worth going because I thought, well, it's dying. I don't want to be mm-hmm. part of the problem. But I've had enough people tell me, no, you've got to. It is pretty incredible. And before I got certified, I did a discovery dive in the Red Sea off of the coast of Hurghada. So I would love to go back now that I'm certified to dive there again because that's the most incredible visibility of anywhere I've been. And the water is not freezing, which is great.
So people listening, and maybe even you as well, have forgotten that this is a side conversation. And we were in the middle of another conversation about you going to Switzerland and leaping out of an airplane above the Alps. And did you say you did that one tandem, or you did?
Yeah, that
one?
Was okay. Tandem.
So you did that tandem, leapt out of a plane above the Alps.
Out of a helicopter.
Oh, out of a helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about this. Tell us about this trip to Switzerland where you did this.
Well, that was the goal. Is I needed to skydive over the Swiss Alps. Apparently, the only place to do it is Interlaken, and the only way to do it is off out of a helicopter because you have to literally go vertical. There is not enough space for a runway in this area. There are mountains everywhere. Absolutely stunning. But while I was there, of course, I had to do other experiences. So I went canyoning and whitewater rafting. And basically, those were the two big things, was canyoning and whitewater rafting on that trip.
It's really nice of them to have the helicopter to accentuate your story about a helicopter.
Actually, I also did a bike tour. I cycled 3 days from Geneva, Switzerland to Annecy, France.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was my first big European bike tour. And now I'm kind of addicted to cycling, which is my fun job now.
Right. We should get to that once we get done talking about jumping out of this helicopter.
You know, the free fall wasn't as much as my first jump. Like at Texas A&M, we jumped mm-hmm. to 17,000 and pulled at 3,000.
Oh, really?
It was like a minute of free fall, which was incredible. But out of a helicopter, you're jumping, I think it was like 13,000. So you lose a lot of the free fall, but the views are just spectacular. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And the nice thing about tandem is you don't have to worry about it because with accelerated free fall, there's so many things you have to worry about that, you know, you have to be in the proper position. And you have to make sure you have the ripcord and blah, blah, blah. That by mm-hmm. the time you've done everything you need to do, it's time to pull.
Right. And you're not paying attention to anything.
No,
except
so you don't get
what
to enjoy.
To do. Right. So you leap above the Alps. Where do they have you land? Are you landing in a valley or are you landing?
Yeah. Yeah. From where the helicopter takes off.
Okay. So you go up vertically and you drop right back down to where you took off from.
Absolutely.
and you just get to stare at the Alps and the Matterhorn and everything else as you get down. What time of year were you there?
I would say, I think it was somewhere around March.
Spring.
Yeah. I mean, there was still snow, but not in the valley. It was snow was only on the mountains.
All right. So we're going to transition now, because you brought it up, to the bike tour. So you said you're leading bike tours now, but before we get to that, let's talk about the bike tour that you did. You said from Geneva to somewhere in France?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how
Geneva,
did
Switzerland to Annecy, France. Mind you, I hadn't ridden a bike in years. Mm-hmm. And I decided, I'm going to go do a bike tour in Europe. It'd be fun to cycle from one country to another. It was along lots of lakes, so it sounded really pretty, really pretty. I'm glad I wore a helmet. Everyone listening, wear a helmet all the time.
We're wearing helmets right now. People might not expect that, but just in case this microphone falls over.
Because I fell twice. And basically, you get there and the company gives you a bike, gives you a very rustic GPS, nothing like the GPSs on our cell phones. Mm-hmm. They tell you what hotels you're going to stay at, and they're like, go. You can go fast, you can go slow, you can take any path you like, but this is where you're going to sleep. And we mostly just try to get from point A to point B. And then once we get to that hotel, then we explore the area. But it was everything from roadways to gravel roads to cycling in between vineyards. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, you're going the wrong way. Sometimes you're going uphill and it's so steep that you have to walk your bike up. At least I did back then, because I wasn't in the shape I'm in today. It was awesome. It was awesome. And you know, I'd never heard of Annecy, France. And I get there and it's like a little Venice. There's canals everywhere, tons of people, beautiful. The food is great. It just, you know, there's just so many beautiful places on the planet that people always think of, oh, let's go to Paris. Yeah, get out of Paris. Go to other places, smaller towns and villages. They're really quaint.
So you do that tour. How long ago was this?
That was on the same trip of the skydiving. So probably about 7 years ago,
I would say. So roughly 7 years ago. And then now you are leading tours. So did you come back to the U.S. and start doing bike tours on your own? Or
no.
Did you just happen to stumble upon this opportunity at some point?
Yeah, well, you know, COVID hit. And I lost everything, all my work, all the jobs, because everything was trade shows, conventions, large scale events. And when the work finally came back and I was actually picked up by a different manufacturer, the level of work was not what it used to be. And so I needed a second job. And I thought, because I spent so much time hiking in Griffith Park during COVID, because that's all I had available, I thought, well, it'd be fun to lead hiking tours up to the Hollywood sign, because that's what I do for fun almost on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I found this company, Bikes and Hikes, and they hired me immediately. And they said, well, are you interested in doing any bike tours? And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I'll check it out. And they had me on a go-see, basically, to be a participant in what's called LA in a Day. And it's 33 miles. You start in West Hollywood, Beverly Hills, Holmby Hills, Bel Air, Westwood, Brentwood, Santa Monica, Venice Beach, Marina Del Rey, Culver City, back. I mean, incredible. And I just had the silliest grin on my face the entire day. And I thought, you're going to pay me to do this? What? Fell in love with it. And I've been doing it for over a year. And it's my fun job. I love it. And now it's leading me to explore more opportunities doing this kind of work. Because it doesn't feel like work. I'm taking people on fun adventures, which is what I've done on my own basically for over a decade, is trying to find fun adventures. And now I'm getting paid to take people on them.
Yeah. So what do these look like? How many hours are you taking people out for? You said it's about 33 miles. So I imagine half a day or full day, maybe even?
Full day. Yeah. We start at 10 o'clock in the morning, finish at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we stop at Venice Beach for lunch. And, you know, you ride, stop, talk, tell some history, write a little bit more. 20 minutes of that is at this incredible estate called Greystone Mansion, which is a public park in Beverly Hills. It's a 46,000 square foot estate on a property of 12 acres, and it's got a fascinating history. But other than that, the rest of the time, you're cycling.
And which celebrity homes do they get to see?
Oh, yeah. We go by Lucille Ball's house and two of Elvis Presley's homes.
Two of his homes?
Yes, because he had three in the area. By the house where Michael Jackson died. Is it Rod Stewart? His future former home, because he's apparently moving back to London. And historical points like the Beverly Hills Hotel and the first U.S. Olympic Village. Culver City, so you go by Culver Hotel, and I love telling that story with The Wizard of Oz. You know, I don't know if you, are you familiar with this story?
I don't know. Tell it. Give people a taste of what they would get if they came on your bike tour.
Okay, so welcome to the Culver Hotel. This hotel was built in 1923, but what makes it very famous is in 1932, do you remember the movie The Wizard of Oz? And everybody says yes.
Yeah.
I'm like,
yep,
remember
yeah,
the Munchkins?
Remember yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, they flew 215 Munchkins from all over the world and housed them in this hotel during the filming of the movie. Wow. So you can imagine, it's the 30s, and these Munchkins have never been on an airplane. They land in Los Angeles. They're at the Culver Hotel. They look around. They see 250 people just like them. What do you think they did? What do you think they did?
Orgy?
Party! Yes, yes. We're going to get to that. So these Munchkins, they partied so hard that some of them didn't make it to set the next day. Those Munchkins, they partied so hard that some that did make it to set left a big old mess all over the floor. Those Munchkins partied so hard that two of them fell to their death from the top floor of the Culver Hotel. But they partied so hard that 9 months later, a lot of babies were born. That's my favorite story on the tour. It gets everyone laughing. It's true, though. It's true. Munchkin orgies.
See, so when I asked you if we were going to do this show, I was like, yeah, we'll probably talk about this and this and this. At no point did I think Munchkin orgies were a topic of conversation. That's the nice thing about this show is there's always going to be surprises. So with that, we are now talking about one of your jobs. We mentioned earlier one of your other jobs, which was that you left Texas to become a performer, ended up working at Pixar, didn't want to do that crap because you wanted to be an actor, and then found out that actually you wanted to be a magician.
Yes.
So let's talk about how that came about. When you go to the mall when you're a teenager, people are like, hey, come over here and join the military, or hey, come do this, but nobody's saying, hey, come be a magician to teenagers in the mall. So how did you stumble upon the opportunity to become a magician?
So I met this magician named Brandon Scott at a production company party. And he's the one who educated me about the Magic Castle. And he said, you should come and see me perform. And I said, okay. So we became friends through Facebook because that was the popular thing back then. And when he performed, he said, come out and check out my show. I'll get you in as my guest. So
you should tell everybody, because some people listening are not going to be from LA, and even some people in LA are not familiar with the Magic Castle. So you should tell everybody a little bit about the Magic Castle and why he had to invite you as a guest.
The Magic Castle is a private club for magicians. It's this Victorian home that sits perched up on a hill with spectacular views. It was built, I guess, close to the turn of the century. Then it became a private club for magicians, thanks to a guy, Milt Larson, and his brother, Bill. And it was really a club for magicians. And you have to audition to become part of this club. And the only way to go is by being invited, personally invited by a magician. I went and saw him perform, and I picked up a... Oop. We are sitting under an orange tree, and they are coming down hard on us.
You know, this is not the first time this season that I'm recording a podcast, and we're having things fall out of trees on us. Last time, it was acorns. This time, oranges are quite larger.
So I go see Brandon perform, and I picked up a program, and I stuck it in my pocket. And then later on, I was waiting for a boss of a job that I was doing, and I pulled the program out, and I looked in the back, and that's when I saw magic classes. And at that time, I was already done with all the acting classes, and I was just looking for classes that sounded like fun. So I did jewelry making classes and candle making classes, and I just love learning and education, any classes I can take, and that's when I saw magic classes. I called. They're like, oh, the next class is going to be in about 6 weeks. And I'm like, how much is it? They're like, $300 for the entire session. I'm like, what? That's like half the price of acting classes. I'm like, sign me up.
And to verify, you are not a kid who had like a magic kit or like little magic cards or any of those sorts of things, right? This is something that came along just out of nowhere for you.
Well, the thing is, growing up, you know, David Copperfield had specials on television.
Right.
And I remember every single time there was a special, I made sure that television was reserved for me because I needed to watch that television special. And as a kid, the only time my parents ever left us alone, they went to Las Vegas and saw David Copperfield perform live in a stage show. So when my mom came back, she was just telling all these stories about the show and how wonderful it was. And I thought, I'm going to grow up someday and I'm going to go see David Copperfield. And that just sounds so amazing. And lo and behold, believe it or not, my husband is building tricks for David Copperfield, and I met him personally and have hung out at his house and on his stage at the MGM. So it's kind of interesting how things come around full circle.
Mm-hmm.
But I also saw Matt King in Vegas, and then I saw him again 20 years later, and I was surprised that I could tell you what had changed because it made such an impact on me when I first saw it that when I saw it the second time, I'm like, oh yeah, he changed the line there. He changed the line there. That trick wasn't there. Like, I had no idea that I would remember it so vividly because I loved it so much. I don't know if it came from nowhere, but the passion has always been there. It
right,
just
so
never...
you were a big fan of it as a child. You just didn't know that you were going to eventually find the path to practicing it.
When I was in grad school, I ordered Jaw-Dropping Magic. And after I watched all the videos and, you know, it seems so amazing. And then you see how it's done. You're like, really? That's it? And I'm like, okay, well, I need to get through graduate school and I need to do all this school stuff. Someday I'm going to study it properly. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I just kind of saw it and put it in the back of my head. And that was it. And lo and behold, the guy in those videos is friends with my husband. And we recently did a road trip and stayed at their house. And I'm like, who knew that? Again, full circle.
You go to the Magic Castle, you find out about these classes. You realize, oh, these classes are inexpensive in comparison to what I'm used to paying for acting classes. I'm going to go take one of these classes. And then what happens?
One class leads to another. So they have a program, and it's Magic 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And when I took the classes for the first time, four of those classes were taught by David Thorson, and one was taught by Mark Wilson, who was the first guy to have a series on television. He's like a legend in magic. He wrote the Bible on magic. And after I went through the program, Dave Thorson went on sabbatical, and Mark Wilson took over all five classes. And I thought, well, different teacher, different material. So I did the entire program again because it was going to be completely different. And I was right. It was different material. And they were so charming. Him and his wife were so charming in the class that I ended up repeating Magic 5 so many times that they kicked me out of class because I just wanted to keep taking classes. And like, all right, you're done taking classes. Now get out there and perform. It's time for you to audition and become a member and get out there and perform. And so I auditioned and got in, and now it's been 11 years that I've been a member. And I just recently completed my week in the Parlor of Prestidigitation. In 2019, I was in the Palace performing stage illusions, thanks to my husband's help, because he was a big stage illusion performer back in the day. Now he strictly builds. And so that's how I quickly got onto the Palace stage. And then COVID hit because I was working on my second booking. Recently, I thought, I just love it so much, I got to get back at it. And lo and behold, yeah, I just made my premiere in the Parlor of Prestidigitation. I want to work all rooms, though. When I started taking classes, I thought to myself, someday I'm going to work all the rooms in this place. And slowly but surely, we're getting there.
How many rooms are there?
Technically, four. Three that work 7 days a week, and then the fourth one only works over the weekends, called a Peller. So I'm currently working on two acts with another female magician, because you have to work with another person for the Peller. And the Palace is with three people, so we already have the third person. So right now I'm developing two more acts for two rooms, and the Parlor I'm alone, which is great. And I'm working on a close-up act, again, by myself. So hopefully in the next couple of years, I will be working all four of the rooms.
Yeah, and something for people who have never been to the Magic Castle, that's pretty interesting and kind of unique about it. Because you can go to, say, Vegas, and you can go to a magic show, and it's basically you're going to walk into a huge auditorium, you're going to watch a show, and you're going to leave. Whereas a Magic Castle, there's a dress code, you're required to dress up, you show up, they bring you into this parlor. You have options. Like, you can hang out at the bar, and you can drink. And while you're at the bar, the bartender might put on a show.
There are five bars, two of which have magic. There's more magic that you can see in one night. Before I met my husband, I was going there three nights a week.
Oh, wow. And you can have dinner there, too. Like, typically you do, right? It's part of the
yes.
experience.
If I give you an invitation, you have to pay a cover charge mm-hmm. and make a dinner reservation. And it adds up. And if you are a drinker, you're going to be putting down $200-$300.
Yeah, it's not an inexpensive night.
No.
But it is a very interesting night. And for anyone in Los Angeles or who visits Los Angeles who can justify the cost, it is a worthwhile experience to at least do once.
Oh, absolutely. And it's the only place in the world where you'll get to experience so many different styles of magic. Close-up, parlor,
right. All in the
stage,
same night. Yeah,
experimental.
All in the same night.
There's also 13 areas where members who are not being paid can also go there and practice their craft, which I've taken advantage of many times. I'll just go there and perform for free just to become a better performer, magician. And
so what is it about magic? What is it? Because there could be a lot of reasons why it speaks to you and why you're passionate about it. But what is it specifically for you that makes you so interested and intrigued by it?
I feel like it's mind-blowing. Like, when you see it and you see something, you just can't believe it. It makes your brain work overtime, basically. It's like a puzzle, and I've always loved puzzles, trying to figure it out. And there's a library inside the Magic Castle that's got almost everything and anything you could ever imagine. Videos, books, periodicals, journals, magazines, everything on magic. And that's where I met my husband, was in the library. I didn't want to have anything to do with men. I just wanted to study magic and be the best female magician on the planet. Seriously, I was a library rat. And lo and behold, in the library, that's where I met my husband, who happens to be one of the top builders of magic in the world. My number one supporter. So, yeah. And anything I want to know, I just go to him and I'm like, how did this happen? So he knows everything, even how David Copperfield banished the Statue of Liberty. Of course, I'm not going to tell you.
I'm not going to allow you to. So building off of that, the fact that you're not going to reveal anything because we don't want you to reveal anything, tell us about magic. Tell us about the different styles of magic, the different types of magic. Give us a look inside that world, because most people listening, we have some sense that there's like illusionist and there's maybe close-up magic, mm-hmm. and there's card magic.
Yeah.
But there's a variety of different types and styles. So why don't you tell us a bit about that?
With close-up, there's coins, cards, ropes can be close up or they can be parlor. People who really excel create their own magic. They're creators. There's also stage illusions. For example, when I performed in the, because people always ask me, so what kind of magic do you do? I'm like, well, when I performed in the Palace of Mystery, I had a professional dancer with me. I tore off his clothes, slashed him across the chest, put him in a box, and removed his head. Needless to say, I don't do kids' magic. There's also children's magic, not my style at all.
Oh, so you're not going to dress up like a clown and do magic tricks?
No. Unfortunately, with my website, I get a lot of requests for children's magic, and I just pass that on to the people who enjoy doing that, because that's just not for me. My last show, though, it was a little bit more family-friendly and comedic. But you have all different styles. You have the dramatic, you have the comedic, you have the guys who just do tricks, or you have the storytellers like me. I like to tell stories. So every one of my presentations has a story that goes with it. And I talk a lot about traveling because that's what my passion is. So I present a lot of magic that I found all over the world, because I also like to inspire people to travel and to get out and do things and to find their passion and be the best at it.
So let's talk about the process of learning magic, because the little bit I do know about magic, it's that it's not the sort of activity that you pick up and then within a few days you're going to be adept at it. It's something that takes practice and practice doing just the most rudimentary of skills that you have to develop, which just trying to twirl a card can be extremely frustrating. I've tried that. It's a pain in the ass. So let's talk about that process, because you went to take these classes. How long did these classes go on for when you would take them?
6 weeks. Every single class is 6 weeks, and there are five of them.
And so when those classes would start, where you were on day one versus 6 weeks later, what kind of progression did you see there?
Well, the interesting thing is, even though Mark Wilson was a phenomenal magician, he wasn't the best teacher, whereas Dave Thorson, his day job was as a music teacher, and magic was just his side thing. And so the way he taught was very different. He would teach you four tricks and grill them in one night, where Mark Wilson would teach you 20 tricks and not grill them. So, of course, the brain is not going to absorb so much information in one class. So that's what I learned, is it's better to focus on one and perfect it than to overwhelm yourself, because literally there's more than multiple lifetimes worth of magic in print, on video, in magazines. There's just so much out there that it can be overwhelming. And after 10 years, I'm at the point where I've forgotten a lot of the things that I learned at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just so much.
Right, and then you build upon those things and then...
Correct. So, but I have focused a few moves that I've perfected over the years. Like, I'm probably one of the few female magicians on the planet that can do a one-handed card shuffle blindfolded.
So what does that look like?
In one hand, you split the cards, you farrow the cards, which means you're interlacing them one at a time, and then you bridge them and shuffle them all with one hand.
And then you take off the blindfold and you say, boom.
And then I topped it by actually blindfolding myself and making a little performance out of it.
So when you were first learning, which did you find the most difficult? And are there any aspects of magic, say like palmistry or anything, where you're like, to hell with this, I'm just not going to learn this one. It's not for me.
Well, you mentioned palming. And the interesting thing is that I always come up with the excuse that, oh, my hand isn't big enough. Well, I've met multiple male magicians whose hands are smaller than mine.
I thought you were going to say who don't have fingers.
There is one.
Oh, wow.
There is one out there, and he can do some pretty incredible things, and he doesn't have hands.
Yeah, that makes palming very difficult.
Yeah, and then there's another one who's blind as a bat, who's an incredible card magician. Richard Turner, there's a documentary about him called Delt. You should watch it. And he's also like third degree black belt. And he's blind as a bat. Pretty incredible.
So palming was difficult for you?
It is. I still haven't been able. I don't attempt to do it in public. I still practice it in front of a mirror because I hope to be able to do it someday. But it's just so challenging that And also forcing cards into people's hands. Some people are really good at it, that no matter what, you can actually have them grab the card you want. And I, again, don't have the balls to do that. I mean, I've tried and I have been successful, but I don't focus on that. I'd rather the magic where it's more about the presentation and the acting than it is about the technical skill of it. Because honestly, a lot of the audience, they don't know. They don't care. They can see something that's buy it now and do it in 5 minutes. Or they can see something that took 5 years to master. And to them, they don't see all the practice. They presentation.
Right. Yeah, it's all about the result. And yeah, exactly what you said, the presentation on how that's delivered. I think probably those magicians whose names we most know, we know them not because they're necessarily the most adept magicians in the world, but that they know how to perform.
Yes.
And put on a show that entertains and intrigues. So when you put on your shows at this point, what types of magic, I know we talked about a little bit, but what types of magic do you tend to focus on? Because we know it's not palming.
Well, that's my problem. That's why I'm progressing so slowly, is I love all aspects and I want to work all the rooms. So when I travel, I carry multiple decks of cards with me. But when I'm at home, I can practice with the larger props that I have. A lot of magic can be learned online these days. And there's also subscriptions to different teachers online. So the access to information when it comes to magic, it's right there. It's at everybody's fingertips. If you want to learn it, it is so easy these days. It's not like when I was a kid where all I had was a local library and there was maybe one book on magic. Now it's everywhere. Websites where you can just download tutorials, plus all the free ones on YouTube. And that's how I spend my time. I don't really watch television. I spend my time researching magic.
So I know this is going to vary based on the trick, but when you're learning something new or when you're bringing something new into your routine, on average, or if you have an example, how long does it take you from, okay, I want to incorporate this trick into my repertoire, from having that thought to being adept enough to actually include it in one of your live performances?
Absolutely. It definitely varies. But one very recent one I can tell you, because my parlor act incorporates Houdini quite a bit. And I'm working with another female magician, and her angle is more Houdan. Houdini was actually inspired by Houdan, but then kind of turned around on him. And because we're developing the show, I thought, well, I can't vanish an elephant like Houdini did at the Hippodrome in New York, but I can string needles in my mouth like he did in the same show. So the elephant was the largest thing he did in the show, and the very smallest thing is he did where he put needles in his mouth, put a piece of thread in his mouth, and then in a couple of seconds, he pulled out the thread and all the needles were attached onto the thread. And I thought, well, I want to learn that. Of course, it's available at the Magic Castle. I went in there and all I had to do was watch the video once. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, needles are sharp. I'm going to hurt myself. This is so dangerous. It's scary. I come home and I start practicing it as the video instructed. It's so easy. I was like, oh my God, I got it already. So now I'm just waiting for the opportunity to perform it because it was incredibly easy. Here I was so afraid that these needles were going to poke me and I was going to be bleeding from the mouth. And literally first try, I could do it. I couldn't believe it.
So you're saying within the first night, you were able to learn this particular trick.
Yes.
All right. So on the short end, we've got one night you can learn a trick. And then on the long end, what's a trick either you're still working on or one that you had to work on for a really long time?
When I did my palace show, there was a lot of dancing involved, and that was very challenging.
The choreography of the
dancing?
Yeah,
that was very hard. My dancer made me look really good, but I still feel like there are a lot of what I did, I didn't. Especially doing it in big monster heels. Mm-hmm. I am not the most graceful when it comes to heels. I was always more of a tomboy growing up, which is why my show that I just completed, I'm in combat boots. I don't want to bother with heels. I'm like, no, I need to be stable. I need to be focused. It needs to be about the audience and not about my feet. So, no, there's stuff. I can do a Sybil cut. A Sybil cut is probably one of the first fancy cardistry moves that really paved the way for so much more cardistry. And that was months. A spring took me 3 months to learn how to spring the cards. But now that I can do it, every time I do it, people are like, wow. The Sybil took me longer than that. And so I'm sitting at the Magic Castle next to one of my teachers that I did privates with. And I'm like, check out what I can do. And I show him the Sybil cut. Sitting next to me is Chris Kenner, who happens to be David Copperfield's producer. And he turns to me and he goes, that was me 30 years ago. He invented the Sybil cut 30 years ago. And here I am showing it off to my teacher. All of a sudden, I went from feeling like, oh my God, I got the Sybil cut. This is so cool. Check me out, to I'm like tiny. I'm like, oh, I'm next to the guy who created it 30 years ago. Oh,
well, you're probably also thinking, oh, I better do it well, because he really knows how it's
done. Well, I'm just glad I didn't drop any cards in front of him, because that would have really been embarrassing. But
So you had mentioned when you were learning, you took a lot of different classes, and then your teacher approached you and said, look, it's time for you to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So that first performance was at the Magic Castle?
No.
No? So where was your first performance?
It was at this variety show called Booby Trap, which I performed many, many times. But all you get is 4 minutes. So it's all kinds of variety performers, and you get 4 minutes to wow the audience.
And where is this?
It was. COVID kind of killed it all, but it went on for years. Mm-hmm. And it was on Hollywood Boulevard at what used to be the club, King King. And they would have it once a week. And it was different performers every single week. And I did that show more than a handful of times every single time I came in with a different routine. You weren't getting paid. Mm-hmm. It was just doing it for fun.
It's like doing open mic night for comedians.
Yeah, but it's high level. So these were top, like, not everyone can just get up on the stage. You have to submit a video. Okay. You have to be good enough. And there were plenty of people who...
So it's not like open mic night.
No. I submitted some stuff that he said, no, come back with a big illusion. I'm like, really? Like, you want me to bring the Briggs stuff, the stuff that costs me money.
So I know you were a performer before. You were an actor. So you're comfortable in front of an audience. But when you change to a different style of performing, there's got to be some sort of...
Well, you see, you're giving me a little bit too much credit.
Because
you say I'm comfortable in front of an audience. No,
oh,
I am
so you're not.
Terrified.
Oh, okay.
But it's, again, that's part of why I love it, because mm-hmm. it feels like I'm jumping out of an airplane. The adrenaline, the kicks I get out of performing is literally like being on a racetrack, jumping out of an airplane, scuba diving with shark. It's that feeling that... Oh my God, this is terrifying, but I'm going to do it anyway. And after you do it, you're like, this is amazing. I can't wait to do it again.
Interesting. So you still feel fear when you perform?
Well, when I started this past week at mm-hmm. the Magic Castle, it started off with being terrified. But I was hoping that as the days progressed, I went from terrified to excited mm-hmm. to confident. And fortunately, I did my homework, and that's exactly what happened. But it was always a lot of energy in my heart, at my throat every single time I get on stage. But it went from terrified to excited as mm-hmm. because I was getting the response that I wanted from the audience. So it felt reassuring mm-hmm. that the fear went away, but the excitement was always there.
Right. Okay. So what I was going to say earlier is, like, once you've switched to a different type of performing, then that fear and all can come back. But had it gone away for you in your other types of performing before you switched to magic? Or are you the kind of person who gets on stage and you do have butterflies and you do feel...
It's always the before thing. It's okay. And mm-hmm. Because every time I did a production, a bilingual foundation of the arts, it was the same thing, where it's like first night, it's terrifying, mm-hmm. but then you get to do it for an entire month or two or three, that it shifts from fear to just pure adrenaline and excitement. And then, of course, things can always happen. I remember one time I went up on my lines. And the whole play was a disaster. So it wasn't just me. The entire play was a disaster. And afterwards, the director reamed us. You don't care. And I can't believe you guys are worth this, blah, blah, blah. Well, I did what nobody else had ever done. And I got up in her face and I'm like, what do you mean I don't care? Look at me. Because I was just, I was so upset that I'd gone up on my lines. And I was crying because I was just so emotional. And I'm like, look at me. I wouldn't be like this if I didn't care. And that was opening night. And so the next night, I nailed it. Because I was like, no, this is not going to happen again. And fortunately, everybody tightened up real quick. So you just can't let one night sort of destroy you. You have to focus and collect yourself and just get right back on and use it as a learning experience as opposed to something that's going to tear you down. Fortunately, I never had any tragedies at the Magic Castle, but I had plenty of things that weren't perfect. So you just never know, especially with audience members. I had a couple of really, really drunk audience members, and that can, if you're not focused, can affect your performance.
Yeah. The audience can definitely be an issue.
Uh-huh, so, especially a drinking audience.
Yeah, so this is interesting to me because never to the degree that you have, but I've been a performer many times in life. Like, I did theater in high school and college. I did ballet and modern dance for a few years and did lots of performances there. I was a puppeteer for 5 years doing performances from everything from a huge event to actually a performance at the Magic Castle, oddly enough.
Really? I need to know more about that.
In a second. To like a birthday party where it's just children and parents not paying attention to what the children are doing. The interesting thing for me is I was a person in life that often could be like uncomfortable in situations with large groups of people, but if you put me on a stage, I was not. So I could be super shy, but then if you threw me up on a stage, it would go away. And a thing that often would happen to me, and I'm curious if this is an experience with you as well, is once I, especially if I'm doing a character, if I can fall into a character, I go somewhere else and I don't exist anymore. And then it's over and I have barely any memory of it almost. It's almost as like a different person inhabited my body. That person did that thing. Right. So you've also had that experience, right?
Oh, no. Yeah. The feeling of being terrified ceases as soon as you cross that curtain and those eyeballs aren't on you. Then all of a sudden nothing else exists except that moment in time, and you forget, and all of a sudden boom, it's over, and you're like, what? Well, why was I so afraid? Like, this is amazing. But absolutely, it's all those emotions just poof, vanish as soon as you get in front of that audience. It's incredible.
Yeah, the thing, and I wonder if magic does this for you. The thing for me, I used to always say, like, I would probably never be like some great dramatic actor, but perhaps I could have been a character actor. Because if you said, here's a special costume, here's a weird prop, here's an accent you need to do, it was super easy for me to just click and be a different person. And I didn't know what I was going to say. Some subconscious part of my body just said things. And then I'm like, wow, where the fuck did that come from?
Yeah.
And so that was really helpful to me, especially when I did puppet shows. If I slipped into a voice, I could just 100% become that character, and that character spoke through my arm. I didn't make up the words, my arm did. So with magic, you've got that. You've got props, and you've got a variety of different items and different things you're hiding. And does that help in the same way, where it's almost like character acting, where it's like, now I have this thing, and it lives through me, and I'm a conduit for what it needs to do? Does that happen?
100%. 100%. It makes it so much easier because of the technical aspects behind of the presentation of that item that you're sharing with people has to be performed in a certain way. So when I got down into writing the script for this last show, all I had to do was analyze, okay, development of which is the least impressive trick, which is the most impressive, like you have to build.
Right. You need to build and end.
And then the beginning and the end and all, it kind of worked itself out just based on the tricks that I knew I wanted to perform. And then I knew I wanted to based on travel. So then each element I researched and how I could bring travel stories into that element. And based on what it was, like, I have this box that has Chinese writing on it. And so then it was easy to come up with the story based on that box because of the Chinese writing. So it obviously came from China. And then I have a pom-pom pole, and I have it inside of a sarcophagus. So that one was from Egypt that we developed. And then a sword, I end with a card stab. So I throw cards in the air and I stab one. And it's obviously the card that the spectator selected just moments before. So I was researching swords and what swords look like, the sword I have. And that's when I found the e-stock. And the e-stock is from France, from a specific period in time. So then I researched, okay, so when was this sword used? During what time period? What wars? And so that's how that story came about, is just because of the look of the sword and my research. Okay, what closely matches? And then it was the Hundred Years' War, because that was the, I think, the most notable war during that time period. Another effect that I do is I have, normally it's presented where you burn a piece of paper, it turns into ashes, you take those ashes, you rub them on your arm, and then there's a revelation. But because you can't use fire at the Magic Castle anymore these days because of a big fire they had back in the day, I thought, okay, what else can these ashes be? And I thought, okay, black sand. So then I researched all the black sand beaches all over the world, and I was like, which is the one that makes the best story? And I found Diamond Beach in Iceland. If you look at pictures of Diamond Beach, it's incredible.
I was thinking you were going to go Hawaii, but Iceland, yeah, would be even more exciting.
And it's Diamond Beach, and so these icebergs wash up onto the shore resembling sparkling diamonds as far as the eye can see. And of course, hello, diamonds are a girl's best friend. So it just made sense that that would be the story. So based on the elements I had, I just had to research and see what made the most sense for me as a person, as a presenter, my likes. Obviously, I love bling, so diamonds were attractive to me.
I know we're going to end this show soon, so I'm going to have to do it because you're going to be mad at me if I don't. So when I said performed at the Magic Castle, that was a very loose use of the word perform. You remember the White Stripes?
Yes.
The band The White Stripes? Their album, Get Behind Me, Satan, which came out in the early 2000s. Do you know the song, My Doorbell?
No.
Okay. So the song, My Doorbell, is like, I'm thinking about my doorbell. When you're going to ring it? When you're going to ring it? They made a music video at the Magic Castle. It's in black and white. They shot it as if it's like an early 1900s film. And they are performing on the stage of the Magic Castle for a room full of children. Well, the children didn't actually watch the White Stripes perform. They watched me and my partner, Michael, who we used to do puppet shows together, perform puppet shows on the stage at the Magic Castle so they could shoot all the reactions of the children to then later cut with footage of the White Stripes performing on stage. So when I say I performed at the White Castle, I mean at the Magic Castle, it was in that regard.
What did these puppets look like?
It was called Moodoo Puppets. It was something Mike created when I first moved to LA. I met him. He was an animator. He used to work on Futurama and other things like that. And when we first met, we were going to work on animated things together, but he also had this puppet show thing going on the side, the Moodoo Puppets. Oddly enough, we never really worked on animation much together, but then he and I worked as puppeteers together for about 5 years, and we did hundreds of performances. He had created a bunch of the puppets ahead of time. Once I joined, we created additional puppets, we wrote new shows, and they always revolved around this little girl named Martina, who would then meet space pirates, who would then get her involved in some mess, and they'd go to outer space and have some sort of journey through outer space where something would happen, and then end up back on Earth at the end. And my favorite character to play was Scurvy, who was a weasel, who was a pirate. The best way I could describe Scurvy is that he was, you know, the kid you grew up with, the kid that didn't get enough attention. And so the only way he knew how to get attention was to get negative attention. But really all he wanted was for everybody to like him, but he couldn't admit that he wanted that. So he would just be a jerk all the time. And he was also kind of a big ninny. So if you ever hit him, he would cry, but he would always act like he was really tough. That's who Scurvy was. Typically, he would cause a problem that initiated their journey, and then they'd go to outer space. And yeah, so we did some of that.
How old were these kids?
Oh, they could range in age. And for the Magic Castle thing, for the White Stripes video, the kids, some of them were probably 4 years old to like seven, maybe 8 years old. And I can say that there is a child crying at a moment in that music video, and I'm positive it is in response to a character I used to play called Blort, who was this huge snail creature who was very loud and verbose, and it was a full body costume, and I'm pretty sure it freaked out that kid, and that's how they got that shot. And you are welcome, White Stripes. So that's enough talking about me. We're gonna get back to you, because this show is about you, not about me. If people want to find out more about your performances, because you said you travel also, right?
Oh yeah.
So people don't just go to the Magic Castle to see you, right? They could see you in a variety of different places?
Well, I'm hoping my next performance will be at the Chicago Magic Lounge. I'm going to be there for my other job as a spokesperson. And unfortunately, a lot of the magic clubs, this is mostly what you get. And so I have to double up with my other job to be able to do my passion. Mm-hmm. And so if things align, I will be performing there in February.
So if people want to see you, how do they find out about your performances and your shows? You have a website, you said earlier?
Absolutely. www.lizdelsoul.com or on Instagram at delsoulmagic. They can follow me on Facebook, follow me on Instagram. I didn't get into the TikTok thing. Too much.
Old. We're too old for TikTok. I've refused to start TikTok. I'm too old for TikTok.
Yeah, but plenty of people actually reached out through the social networks, and I was able to get them in as my guest the week that I was performing.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, so that's another thing. If people wanted to go to the Magic Castle, they need someone to invite them. And so maybe if you're really nice to Liz, you can get her to invite you to the Magic Castle.
Yeah, absolutely. Reach out on my website, write there that you heard this podcast, and I would gladly grace you with an invitation to the world famous Magic Castle. And it's good for 4 people, and it's valid for several months. And as long as you mention this podcast, I will definitely give you an invite.
And what if people want to go on a bike ride with you? What if they want to hear more stories in addition to the Munchkin story?
Bikes and hikes, and request me, because actually on the lunch break I do share magic with people. That's the one bonus that you get by going on a tour with Liz Del Sol, is that you actually get to see some real live magic during the lunch break.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's great fun. You'll see some rubber band tricks and some card tricks, but that's my little addition that I do on my bike tours.
So before we do get to the end of the show question, I do want to hear about, because we talked about when you first did finally your magic performances. Where was the place called? What was it called?
You're talking about Booby Trap?
Booby Trap. I knew it was something that sounded like breast, but I couldn't remember what it was. So first you were doing your shows at Booby Trap. What was it like when you did your very first show at the Magic Castle? Because that's got to be a special place for you. It's where you're learning how to do these tricks. It's where your mentors are.
Yeah.
And so the first time you go in there, what was that experience like? The first time you go in there to perform?
Well, I went in there and performed non-paying multiple times. But my first paying gig was in the Palace, is the one I told you where I tore the clothes off my dancer and slashed him.
Okay, so that was the first time?
Yeah. Yeah, that was my first big booking at the Magic Castle. I've also performed at Labyrinth of Jareth multiple years.
Oh,
I might go back and do it again.
For people who don't know what that is it Christmas time when they do that?
It's in August.
It's in August, okay. Mm-hmm. And it's a big event. It's based on the Labyrinth movie, the Henson movie from back in the 80s. And people dress up like the various characters from that show or inspirations from that show. And then there's magic. And are there acrobats also? Am I remembering correctly?
There's all kinds of performers, different rooms that you can explore. I haven't done it in the last couple of years just because it's landed on my birthday weekend. But I've done that at least 3 years in a row. And if it happens to not be on my birthday, then I will do it again because it's great fun.
So that first performance went well?
Yeah.
No crazy jitters? No tricks went wrong?
No, nothing went wrong. It was interesting because I had the videographer of the Magic Castle come out and film me two nights. And because I felt like, you know, it's the curse of the camera. And things didn't go exactly the way I wanted the first night. So I paid for him to come back a second time. And it felt so different. And then when I went back and watched the performances, they looked virtually identical.
Of course.
But for me, it felt so different. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be so much better the second time. And then I looked at it, I'm like, oh my God, I wasted my money.
Yeah, of course. And maybe there's nothing. But is there something that you could share about magic that you think most people don't get? Or like, if there's something that once you started studying magic, you realize, oh, I always thought this all along, and this is completely wrong.
My husband thinks that most magicians are social cripples. And so they use magic to be able to communicate with others.
I think that's true about a lot of performers. I really do.
Well, I mean, you have to be a little bit off to even pursue anything in the arts because it's so darn difficult. People always ask me for advice. I'm like, if there's anything else you can do that makes you happy, do that.
Yeah, that's what I tell people about all of the creative arts.
Yeah.
You only pursue this because you have to.
Yes, absolutely, because if you didn't, that would make you miserable.
Right.
And so that's kind of how I feel about it, is if I don't do magic, I'm not living to the fullest. But then I also feel that about doing extreme sports. Fortunately, I have a lot of outlets that give me that satisfaction. You have to have multiple jobs to make ends meet as a performer. To make a living just performing, you have better chances of winning the lottery. Mm-hmm. than to make a lot of money as a performer, which is why a lot of magicians sell products and consult and do all these other different things, do lectures, work conventions, which isn't my jam. You just got to find what works for you, what you're passionate about, and go with that.
So I may have accidentally just had you do it, but in case I did not, the way I always end the show is I ask you if there is a final thought that you'd like to leave the audience with, based on everything we've talked about, or even something we didn't talk about, that there's just something on the top of your head that you think, this is what I need to share with the audience.
Find the thing that you love that terrifies you and do it. Find that thing that gets your heart pumping, the adrenaline pumping, that scares the crap out of you, and go do it. Because a good bowel movement is very good for the body.
And to build on top of that, because sometimes people hear that sort of advice and they think it's foolhardy, or they think like, oh, it's those crazy adrenaline junkies. And it's really not about that. When you face a fear, you learn something about you.
Absolutely.
And what you learn is really valuable.
100%.
Well, thank you for going to Griffith Park with me so we could get kicked out by the police so that we can now come hang out in your backyard under the tree that only attacked us once and we saw a baby possum. But yeah, thanks for sitting down with me.
Thank
and
you.
And recording this.
Yeah, it was lots of fun. I really appreciate it. I hope the listeners learned a little something and go out there and live an adventure life.
So if you were paying close attention during the show, you may have heard Liz say that you can reach out to her and request an invite to the Magic Castle. And now might be a good time to do that because she will be performing March 27th through 31st back at the Magic Castle. This will be her third time performing there and her third room. So if you want to be part of that, if you want to check that out, get in touch with her as she described earlier in this show, or head to LizDelSoul.com and reach out to her there through her contact page. Liz also completed a marathon earlier in February. She's running another one in April in Ventura from mountains to beach, and she will be running yet another marathon in Switzerland in September. And on top of that, in May, she will go to Nepal to hike to Everest Base Camp and climb Island Peak. And now it's that part of the show where I invite all of you to come to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 115 with Liz Del Sol in the podcast section, and there you will find numerous photographs of Liz in action and links to everything we talked about in today's show, including LizDelSoul.com, where you can contact her for tickets to her show at the Magic Castle. If you haven't gotten it in your head yet, see if you can get an invite to the Magic Castle. You know, if you are going to be in the Los Angeles area. And if you should want to contact us here at this show, you can do that a number of ways. You can send us an email, jason@gogetoutside.com, or send us a text or leave a voicemail at 818-925-0106. And of course, as always, like I always say, please go to your podcast purveyor of choice, subscribe, rate, review, and share the show with someone who you think will like it. Next time on the show, come back for a fun-filled April Fool's Day with Jerry Nicholsberg. You may recall him from the Caving Roundtable episode years ago. Well, he is back for his own episode, and there's a lot to talk about. He is an accomplished person. Come back April 1st for conversations about scuba diving, caving, hiking, economics, mountaineering, climbing, and white water scuba diving. April 1st, Jerry Nicholsberg. See you then.